Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Sean Foley is an assistant professor of history here at MTSU. His teaching fields are the Middle East and Islamic history, the Arab-Israeli dispute and world history, and his expertise could not be more timely. On January 21st, he delivered a presentation at the American University in Beirut titled Revolution or Tajdid, if I'm pronouncing that correctly?
Close. Tajdid.
Tajdid. Thank you. Islam, Thomas Jefferson, and the Rise of American Liberty. One of its major points was that Islam has had more of an impact on Western ideas than you might think. Dr. Foley earned his Ph.D. in history from Georgetown University in 2005 and his master's in Arab studies from Georgetown in 2000. His forthcoming book next year from Lynn Reiner Press is titled The Arab Gulf States When Oil Is Not Enough. Sean, welcome to MTSU on the Record.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for taking the time to have me onto your show. And I should add that this lecture not only was a lecture, it's going to be an article in the Journal of World History in September of this year.
That's terrific. I'm going to get a copy of that.
Absolutely.
Many of us Europeans and Americans are ignorant of Islam's impact on fundamental aspects of our society. Why?
Why? Well, first, when talking about Americans versus Europeans, and specifically with Americans, we have a tradition of thinking about American history and the way we think about history in many ways assumes that America had a certain group of people who came from Europe or Asia or other places, came to the United States, and that America wasn't engaged with the rest of the world until the mid-20th century, until World War II, when we became what was seen as a global power. And this is a way of looking at history, and there's much truth in this, but in reality that hides other histories and other ways and other influences that Americans have had for a much longer period of time.
We learn about Locke and Mill and Rousseau, but we don't learn about other people.
No, well, and also when we think about Locke, Mill, and Rousseau and those other people, we don't necessarily learn about the fact that those individuals lived in a time and space very different from ours, and in which Islam, for instance, was a much more character world, much more creative and much more tangible thing. We think, for instance, of Americans in the 18th century. Americans frequently traveled to the Muslim world for trade, for instance, back and forth. So these type of issues are very much alive and well. Americans in the 18th century included as part of the theological doctrine, as part of the conversation about themselves, their own identity of themselves in the world, meant defining themselves in relation to Muslims in a way that we don't necessarily see or see as very different today.
Do we see the Muslim world as the other, the way that Americans saw African-Americans and Native Americans as the other?
Potentially, sure, absolutely. And indeed, not only is it the other, but they're also a world that is seemingly far away. When you asked about Europeans versus Americans, Europeans live in a world in which Islamic states and Islamic societies are far closer, you know, just in physical distance. Sort of Muslim-majority societies can be seen almost from parts of Europe. You can look across or just take a short boat ride from parts of Spain or Italy, and you're in an Islamic world.
You said in the American University presentation that there have been three major turning points in the use of Tajdid, and we need to define that word for our audience, as an engine of social renewal. There were the Reformation, the rise of European nationalism, and the emergence of Anglo-American forms of natural law and human rights. So could you take us each of those in turn for us and explain their relationship to this nexus of Islamic and Western ideas?
Sure. So when we talk about Tajdid, these are sort of two different terms. Tajdid is specifically an Islamic term, but talks about renewal and reform within Islamic societies, in which Islamic societies look back to the period of the Prophet and try to reform their societies to better fit the ideal that Muslims had during the Prophet's lifetime, during that initial community. And this is a trend that goes through. What I'm suggesting is that in the same way that Muslims look at this ideal of Tajdid and reform, Europeans, what would become Americans, use Islam as a way to similarly reform their own societies over different periods of time. And again, this continues on into the modern period. And the first example that you talked about has to do with the Reformation. And in the Reformation, Islam was a very tangible part of Europe. Muslim armies, particularly that of the Ottoman Empire that had significant Muslim but also significant Christian and Jewish elements as part of it, were actively moving into Europe.
Spain would be an example of that.
Oh, even before that, actually, when we think about in the 15th and the 16th century, Spain had already lost much of its Muslim identity, but absolutely Spain had been an important part of the Muslim world, an important conduit by which ideas that we think of as part of the Western tradition, Greco-Roman traditions, were translated often from Greek and Roman into Arabic and then from Arabic into Western languages. Absolutely. But by the 15th century, by the sort of initial part of where I talk about in the discussion, this is when the Ottoman Empire, a state that we often know as Turkey, based in the ancient city of Istanbul, also known as Constantinople, was expanding into Europe and causing a significant challenge. It looked, for instance, as if Vienna, one of the central cities and the heart of Europe, was going to fall. This was a tangible idea, a reality that significant portions of Europe. And this man Luther comes along. And Luther is a German. He's a man who looks at the Catholic Church and sees significant problems. And in fact, part of his worldview is that he sees Islam as an example of the problems that is facing the Catholic Church. It's a symptom of problems of God's anger on earth, he would say in that way. And it's a symptom that we need to repent and reform.
It's an omen for him.
Absolutely. And for him, not only an omen, but for him, it was important for Europeans to understand what Islam was. So if they understood what Islam was, they could understand just how weak the Catholic Church was and how unable it was to defend Western Christendom from this impending attack from Islam. Ironically for him, proving Islam and spreading Islam's mission within Europe, spreading what Islam was critical to his own program of reform in Europe.
Well, obviously he was able to do so because Protestantism took hold. Do you think Protestantism would not have taken hold had he not based his beliefs on what he considered to be an omen?
It's very difficult when we talk about historians to look back because we can't go back and test things.
It's hard to say what if.
But one can say with a great amount of certainty as the presence of the Islamic Empire, of the Ottoman Empire in Europe, and particularly Suleiman the Magnificent, a very powerful ruler in the 16th century, radically transformed the state of Europe and created opportunities for Protestant communities, but also for other Catholic communities, other states in Europe, to assert themselves in ways politically that they wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. A good example during Luther's lifetime is during the 16th century, the French king, Francis I, is captured by the Spanish. There's a direct rivalry between Spain and France. He's captured and he sends a message through his mother, no less, to Sultan Suleiman asking for help. And Sultan Suleiman, who's a powerful state, he has an army as well as a navy of incredible power, decides to ally with the French as a way of balancing out power in Europe. And France, as he actually admitted, the King of France, Francis admitted to a Venetian diplomat, would not have been able to be independent without Ottoman power. So in reality, maybe, maybe not, but we can certainly say that the presence of Islam allowed for Protestant states, allowed for France and other states to take hold in a way that they might have not been able to otherwise.
Even if leaders of the European nations did not buy into Luther's religious arguments or his omen theory, they would certainly understand, being the rulers that they were, the balance of power issues involved.
Absolutely. They'd be involved with the balance of power issues, and it would go even to gender. A good example is Elizabeth I. Dealt with, for instance, in her battles with the Spanish, and again, she being a Protestant queen, actively sought to seek alliances with the Ottoman Empire. And indeed, there were powerful women in the Ottoman court, and her position as a woman, she actively used that as a way to communicate with those women to win Ottoman support. Indeed, they communicate back and forth things like makeup and other types of things. It's a remarkable correspondence, not only on a religious level, on a political level, but also gender. Women who were in positions of power and understood they had something in common.
Was it widely known at the time that they did that?
Absolutely, yes. Her government officials understanding that there were powerful women in the Ottoman court actively promoted the fact that we have a powerful queen to win those women's support.
So it did not have to be clandestine in any way?
No, absolutely not. No, it was quite public.
Okay.
And it was to win not only political favor, but at that time, France had a close economic relationship with the Ottoman Empire. And what she wanted was commercial privileges for British merchants.
you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Yes, absolutely.
What about the rise of European nationalism?
When we think about nationalism, and the point about England is a good one, is that the actual experience we tend to think of in European history, there's at least an understanding of the Ottoman Empire, especially to the Battle of Lepanto at the end of the 16th century, this great battle in which the Ottomans fought the Europeans, and for the first time the Europeans won. And there's sort of this assumption that Ottoman power begins to dissipate or disappear. In reality, that's not the case. The Ottomans are still a factor in Europe well into the 19th, into the 20th century, and indeed over a million Christian Europeans from places as different as Italy to Iceland are actually seized by Muslim privateers. And that actual action of being captured on the high seas and ending up in places like Algiers in North Africa becomes an engine, an experience to define themselves versus the other. And it informs not only a political debate, how do we defend our people, but also it impacts high literature. Shakespeare is one of a number of people. Don Quixote also includes clear elements that involve Muslims and, in fact, interactions with Muslims.
And in Shakespeare, Othello the Moor?
Absolutely. Othello the Moor, or as I mentioned, Henry V, in that speech, there's a specific example where he gives a speech trying to woo the queen of France to his side, and he says, "Our son, half French, half English, will go seize Istanbul, seize Constantinople from the Turk." So this is part of our national mission, is to fight the Ottomans. What's interesting is that Shakespeare took a bit of poetic license with this, because there's no way Henry could have ever made that speech because Constantinople had not fallen to the Turks until well after Henry made the marriage proposal to the Queen of France.
Was there some kind of a grudging respect going on between the European leaders and the Ottoman Empire vis-a-vis military strength, given that the British and the Dutch and the Spanish were into their period of colonialism and conquering nations, conquering lands, I should say, around the world?
Absolutely. If you look at where the Europeans go, the Europeans would have preferred to go take the trade routes that existed that connected Europe with Asia, particularly China. Those were the wealthy routes. Well, the people sitting on top of those were Muslims. So if you're going to go out and deal with the world, you can't go east. Yeah. The Muslim power is too strong. You have to go west. And there's a grudging respect not only of military power, but of cultural power and economic power. Our ideas of a plantation, for instance, Oakland Plantation, for instance, in Murfreesboro, those ideas of plantation actually come originally from Muslim settlements in places in the Mediterranean. And indeed, many of the initial people who would settle in the New World under English expansion, Captain John Smith, is an excellent example, are people who had spent time fighting Muslims or interacting with Muslims. Mm-hmm. So it's not only Muslim military power, but cultural power as well as economic power that gets picked up and moved, and things that still influence us today.
What about the emergence of Anglo-American forms of natural law and human rights, which, again, we tend to go back to the Enlightenment thinkers of Britain and think that was the genesis, or the sole genesis, of Jefferson and Franklin's and Madison's views of what this country should be?
Absolutely. And again, what we tend to forget when we sort of go back to the, some people may call dead white males, these older people, is that they're in a world in which their thinking about is law. Indeed, I begin the speech that you at AUB by remembering that in 1765, when the Stamp Act is passed, the first thing that Jefferson does, he's so angry at the Stamp Act. He's a young, fiery young man who thinks he understands English constitutional law. And here the English pass this crazy Stamp Act. The first thing he does is he goes and buys a Quran because he wants to understand where natural law comes from. He has read before that natural law can include Islamic texts. And he says, you know what? The English have done something so completely out of the box, so completely incomprehensible to me, that I need to start looking at other things. And one of those things he automatically picks up is Islam.
And indeed, you would also point out that Keith Ellison, the U.S. representative from Minnesota, I believe it is, took the oath of office on Thomas Jefferson's copy of the Koran, which was, he caught some conservative flack from that in certain circles, but other people praised him for it.
Yes, well, one of the things about our Constitution, and let me back up one other thing, other people we should note, when we think about religious traditions and what these dead white males knew, to get religious training in the United States up until the 20th century, sort of high-level training, you would often have religious training have to learn Arabic, because it's a good language to know, along with Hebrew and other texts used to understand scripture. So this is the idea that you would be aware of Islam or these type of scriptures wouldn't be a surprise to the people who would be writing the Constitution.
It would seem that the people in the 1700s, despite their lack of our modern transportation and communication conduits, were far more cosmopolitan in their outlook and far more holistic in their outlook of other cultures than we are today, because we are living in a time of very blatantly expressed xenophobia. And I just kind of wonder if we're going to be able to continue discussions like these without viewing them through a prism of anti-Muslim prejudice and misconception.
I would actually back up. One of the things I would say is, in terms of xenophobia, these type of issues and global perspectives are things that people today are in many ways very globally minded, and even more so than many people in the 18th century. I would actually argue that there was xenophobia in the 18th century, as well as there's xenophobia today. The outcome of the arguments of the 18th century certainly led away from xenophobic ideas. But I would actually caution you to say that the types of ideas, the types of institutions, what Jefferson was doing in his time, his suggestions, not only his, but also what would become the U.S. Constitution, were radical notions. And indeed, the U.S. Constitution, as a document, there was open discussion. Should there be more specific mention of explicitly Christian notions? Most of the people writing the documents were practicing Christians, but they believed for a variety of reasons that it made sense not to have Christianity specifically mentioned in the document, and most importantly, and this is where your point about Keith Ellison is important, not to have a religious test.
Keith Ellison, it should be pointed out, was the first Muslim
elected
to the U.S. Congress.
Elected from a district that actually includes not only Muslims, but also Jews. When he was nominated to become the Democratic equivalent of the Democratic Party nominee from a liberal district in Minnesota, he said shalom first, then salam aleikum, in a recognition that his victory owed not only to Muslim voters who had worked hard for him, but people of other faiths, including Jews. And what's important is in the Constitution made a change. In the 18th century, most state constitutions had a religious test. You actually had to swear allegiance that you were a Christian in order to serve in high office.
And our U.S. Constitution specifically prohibits the religious test.
That's correct. In fact, you actually swear an oath not to the Bible, but actually to the Constitution. Indeed, when most people do those shots, like Keith Ellison on a Quran or those on a Torah or those on that, that's just for show. Mm-hmm. In reality, you are swearing an oath to the U.S. Constitution. This was a radical notion in the 18th century. In fact, there was a debate that occurred in the North Carolina legislature in the 18th century. Look, if we don't put in a religious test, does that mean at one point in the future a Muslim or even the Pope might become a president of the United States? There's an open debate about this. Mm-hmm. When you talk about xenophobia in our age versus the 18th century. And indeed, the argument was, well, yes, that's possible, but in our world, we don't think it's possible that a Catholic will become president for at least another 500 years. As we know with the election of John F. Kennedy, that didn't quite work out that way.
And it was a question at the time as to whether or not his Catholicism would dictate the direction in which he would take the country. One wag tried to put that aside by saying, I'm more worried about the pop than the pope, referring to Kennedy's father. But Kennedy made a speech, I believe it was in Houston, in which he very eloquently put those fears to rest.
Yes, absolutely. And again, saying I serve at the country, I serve that type of image. With that as the idea of him saying, look, religion won't be an issue, I won't take direct orders from the Pope. That is still a tension even in the 20th century. So that's one of the things I said about being careful about assuming that people in the 18th century are more worldly. We're very worldly today. In fact, Middle Tennessee benefits, and Tennessee in general in the nation, benefits from the immigrants who have come here, from the types of perspectives they bring, the languages that they allow us to bring, the culture, and not to mention the food. Think of all the great restaurants that you have access to here in Tennessee.
The national media, I remember, was making fun of a year or two ago of the fact that Nashville was one of four locations where the surveys of Kurds were going to be taken, and they didn't understand why. They didn't know Nashville has the largest Kurdish population of any city in the United States.
Indeed, it is known as the capital of Kurdish America.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much so for that reason. And indeed, Kurds, one sees them as students on this campus. They have businesses. They've made lots of tangible contributions to our community, not only in Murfreesboro, but also in the larger Middle Tennessee community.
You talked about a post-18th century use of Tajdid called Islamic modernism. How do you define Islamic modernism?
Islamic modernism is a specific type of tradition that emerged in the 19th century. And it comes from several thinkers, a man named Muhammad Abdul, another man named Alif Ghani. These are elite thinkers in the 19th century. And it came from the very real impact of European power. You know, in the 16th, 17th century, in that period, Islamic power is very strong. But by the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire is actually known not as a fearsome empire that can scare Spain or France, but it's known by this point as the sick man of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And in this time period, Muslims who had thought that their culture was at least superior or equal to that of European culture suddenly have to live in a world where it's pretty clear that European economic and political power is unbelievably superior to that of even the strongest Islamic state, the Ottoman Empire. And indeed, there were millions of Muslims in this period who are actually under direct colonial rule in places in Africa, in the Middle East, and in Asia, all the way from West Africa to Indonesia. And Muslims have to think, okay, where do we go wrong? How do we deal in this world? And Islamic modernism is an attempt to try to synthesize, in this period, at least attempt to synthesize, modern ideas with Islamic ideas, Western ideas. And the assumption for someone like Alif Ghani and Abdu is, look, these Western ideas, these traditions dealing with science and technology are actually truly Islamic ideas as well, and that we need to redefine them. And if we can redefine them, we can rediscover our own culture. We'd rediscover our own culture. We can have an Islamic rebirth and push off the power of European colonialism. And what's important about this is that this idea of recreating Muslim societies wouldn't necessarily work. Abdul and Afghani's political programs never worked, but they would spawn a program that exists all the way to today by which Muslims in various forms use modern ideas and modern technologies to support specifically Islamic movements.
I was going to ask you that there is not one specific concept of Islamic modernism today, as there are different variants of it. Could you talk about what various forms it takes today?
Oh, various forms today. Well, in many ways, Islamic modernism is a specific term one can refer to as somebody like Muhammad Abdul and Alif Ghani. Abdul was an Egyptian cleric. Alif Ghani was someone from Afghanistan. These were political figures trying to reconcile these ideas. Today, Islamic modernism has taken various forms, sort of subsequent forms. One is in Turkey, where there would be a modern state that would transform. A man named Mustafa Kemal Atatürk transformed the Ottoman Empire and transformed Turkey into a secular state, which is clearly secular in the European sense of the word, but also Muslim simultaneously. Others have thought to redefine Islam as an ideology, transforming it not from a religion, but thinking of it in terms of a concept like Marxism in certain ways by which Muslims have things in common because they are Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
A man named Hassan al-Banna in Egypt would spawn this idea of Islam, sort of Muslim Brotherhood, this idea of this linkage together into an organization that would become the Muslim Brotherhood and spawn ideas that we can see a direct link actually to Al-Qaeda today.
Mm-hmm.
And those type of Muslim organizations, although Al-Qaeda is an organization that we think of as a terrorist organization and has perpetrated great acts of violence, it is also an organization whose lead leaders are educated in Western concepts. Ayman al-Zawahiri, for instance, is a doctor.
Yeah.
Osama bin Laden is actually educated in public affairs, was his actual degree. And these people utilize Islamic ideas, but within a concept and with technologies like the internet, like modern conceptions of business that are clearly Western.
And so these variants can be, they can be both moderate and extreme. They
Absolutely.
Can go from one end of the spectrum to the other.
Indeed, there are other examples as well, dealing with women, that there have been women who have gone back and said, using Tajdi traditions, using these traditions, how can we redefine feminism in a concept that is understandable within the Islamic tradition? Do we need to just look at Western ideas, or can we look at women in the tradition, say a woman like Aisha, the wife of the Prophet Muhammad, as someone we can use to learn to redefine ourselves, where we can be both modern, recognizably modern, and also recognizably Islamic? So you'll see women, for instance, in countries wearing what we see, the veil, but also actively involved in public or in business affairs.
You know, when I talk to international students here and people who have had the opportunity to go abroad, some people say that people from other countries outside the United States love our commerce, love our culture, love Americans, but they are still of the impression that there are certain elements of our population that really need to get up to speed on what it means to be a global citizen and to become more aware of cultures outside our own. Do you think that this is changing?
Well, first, we're an enormous nation. We are an enormous nation not only in our population, but also physically in our space. And much of the rest of the world is far away. It is not a surprise that Americans, including those who live in Tennessee, have limited experience dealing with those from outside and think these ideas are strange. That's not odd at all. And indeed, when one visits other societies in the world that are as large, one sees similar types of ideas or lack of familiarity. Do I think that we are moving to a point, I'm conscious to lecture others about how they should believe, but I think there are more and more opportunities for more and more Americans to see what the rest of the world looks like, to see the types of foods, the type of perspectives that they have, and what we can benefit. And I would say, for those who criticize us, look at our president today. The man who we elected president is named Barack Hussein Obama. He is the son of a man from Kenya who came to the United States and met a woman from Kansas. He is a man, it's remarkable. He made his first trip to Canada. He said, oh, I'm happy to be here because I have family from Canada. His family from all over the world. So we may have perspectives, but certainly I would caution, if Americans are willing to give a significant amount of their votes, over 50+% of the electorate voted for Obama in the 2008 election, that suggests a comfort level and a familiarity with the rest of the world that we should be proud of.
Do you think that his election symbolizes an easing of sort of the post 9/11 tensions and fear, and moving into a perspective where we can balance our national security concerns with a rational acceptance and tolerance, acceptance of and tolerance for people of all different kinds of cultures?
I certainly hope so, and it certainly seems as if that the promise is there, that the very election of Obama and its signature not only to the United States but the rest of the world of what is possible is certainly a good harbinger for different things. It's worth noting, for instance, that Ayman al-Zawahiri, one of the lead people of al-Qaeda, used to always issue tapes. And these used to be front page news. But more and more, these tapes sort of happen and nobody notices. That probably suggests that the era after 9/11, that world is evolving. Does that mean that the threat of terrorism is not there? Does that mean that we don't necessarily have people who wish us harm? Absolutely not. But the initial worldview, the initial terror after that world, and potentially a new way forward, I think is there.
The misconceptions remind me of the people who have similar misconceptions about America being a quote-unquote Christian nation, when, in fact, Jefferson was a deist, and I believe Franklin, I have heard, was an atheist.
Sure, and indeed, we are a nation, and also what's important is to say a nation of Christians is not the same thing as a Christian nation.
Right. It is not a theocracy.
That's correct. And we in terms of how we are today as a nation, we certainly have a significant population of Christians, but also other people as well. And indeed, part of my own work is to let us realize that the multiplicity, the multi-religious aspects that we see in our society today that we applaud ourselves for, the multi-diversity, what I refer to using Ishmael Reed's term, multi-America, is actually not a new thing at all. It's been part and parcel of our culture in various forms from the beginning.
Dr. Sean Foley, an assistant professor of history here at MTSU. His book, which will be out in 2010, is from Lynn Reiner Press. It's called The Arab Gulf States When Oil Is Not Enough. Thanks for being on MTSU On the Record. We really appreciate it.
We very much appreciate the opportunity to speak to you on air. Thank you.
Okay. This is MTSU On the Record. You can join us again at this same time next Sunday. Go to mtsunews.com and check out the podcast at your leisure. And don't forget, we're also on iTunes. I'm Jenna Logue. Have a good day.